I found it so compelling, this idea that authors could be in control and could make their work public when they saw, you know, it was the right time to do so, right? And that felt incredibly empowering. It felt like it would completely change how science was done.
I'm not sure if anyone out there is ranking lab taglines or how many labs even have a tagline. But in any poll, my vote will go to Dr. Prachi Avasthi's and upwardly motile Chlamydomonas laboratory. Prachi is a cell biologist at Dartmouth. Her lab focuses on the study of cilia in Chlamydomonas reinhardi. Prachi is also the president of Accelerating Science and Publication in Biology, or ASAP Bio, a scientist-driven nonprofit that is EMBO's partner in the refereed preprint platform Review Commons. More recently, Prachi was appointed chief scientific officer at Arcadia Science, and she explained to us a bit about the organization and its mission. We also discussed various topics in open science, the importance of community, and of course, preprints and peer review. Welcome to the EMBO podcast. I've always thought of neuroscientist as a terminally differentiated phenotype. From Delbruck to Tonegawa, you did your molecular biology, or in Delbruck's case, helped create molecular biology, or your immunology, and then you rode off into neuroscience. Prachi, on the other hand, started out in a neuroscience PhD program and then moved to cell biology in a single-celled green alga.
When I think about my sort of scientific career in getting into research, I had started doing laboratory research as an undergraduate student at the University of Illinois. And I had done a whole host of different types of research experiences, from ecology to neuroscience, entomology. I tried lots of different things, and I was immediately hooked on neuroscience. I thought neurons were extremely interesting cells, and I was just learning about it in my courses. And that was the laboratory where I spent the most of my undergraduate research, was in neuroscience. And back then, it actually was pretty uncommon for there to be a graduate programs in neuroscience. So it was, there were lots of, you know, molecular biology and other types of graduate programs. And there were only a few neuroscience graduate programs in the country, in the U.S. And so I was hooked on the research, and I decided to go, pursue that. And, I had also sort of somewhat of a circuitous path in graduate school, because I switched labs also as a graduate student in neuroscience. But the place where I landed was actually, you know, pretty much a cell biology lab, where the cells we were studying were neurons. They were photoreceptors. So they're neurons, but they were really interesting for their cell biological properties. And so, you know, in many ways, it seems like I sort of got into neuroscience and then moved out of neuroscience. But the research I was doing as a graduate student on trafficking in photoreceptors, and actually in photoreceptor cilia, is something that, you know, I just went on to do in a different system. So rather than using photoreceptors as, you know, the cells that were of interest, I moved on to using a more genetically tractable and sort of more biochemically tractable system, using green alga as a model for studying cilia rather than photoreceptors. So even though one type of cell happened to be a neuron, I was very much studying similar research when I moved on from that.
And actually, I want to come back to something you just mentioned, because in an interview to the SCB, they had asked you, can you describe one formidable experience from your life or training that set you on this path? And what you mentioned is something you've just mentioned again, is that, but actually in the interview, it's clear that it was quite late in your graduate studies. In the fourth year, you switched labs. What happened?
Yeah. So, I mean, it was, not perfect fit in the graduate lab, and several people had sort of moved from, you know, that labs to another one. So, mostly for, you know, I think people, when as they move in their trajectories and their science trajectories, they learn a lot more things. They have a lot of different interests, and Yeah, it was just like it was not a great sort of environment, I think, for the scientist that I was growing into and having the right sort of environment around me. So I think I moved to one that was you know, much more sort of fitting my scientific interests.
And the program was supportive of a switch?
Yeah,
switch.
They were fantastic, actually. I mean, it's funny because, you know, things the way that you perceive your career in science changes over time, right? And when I think back on it now, I thought, you know, the program was extremely supportive in, you know, allowing me time and space, finding the right, you know, laboratory to land in. My, you know, ultimate graduate advisor was fantastic. He sort of looked at it as an opportunity. He was saying, "Oh, I hear, you know, you're basically a postdoc," you know? And so it was, you know, it was a really sort of a win-win situation when I moved to the new lab.
No, that's great, because it usually what people are advised is, as I'm sure you know, is just tough it out and get your degree and then you can do what.
Well, I probably did both, right? Because I moved so late. I did tough it out for a while and then I decided not to. and so, you know, it turns out you can do, you know, more than one thing. And I guess I learned so many things from that experience. One is just that, that I have long felt that we have a lot more sort of control over what, you know, our careers than often we feel like we do. Even at that time, I felt completely, I remember feeling sort of at the mercy of other people and what I would be allowed to do and what I would be, you know, scientifically allowed to pursue. But, you know, even in that experience in hindsight, you know, everyone had asked me what it is that I wanted, you know, what did I want out of science? What did I want out of this graduate program? And how did I want that future to look? And largely what happened after that was shaped by what it was that I wanted. So I think that, you know, I also, you know, gained the support of a lot of people at that time, you know, people who wrote me, you know, letters of support for years, maybe a decade afterwards, you know, so it was really a formative experience that helped shape how I think about, you know, sort of our agency in the system and what we should, you know, feel like we have the freedom to do. I think often we feel trapped and that is, you know, because of course there are always people with more power than us, you know, and even so there is leeway that sometimes we don't take advantage of. And so I think I explored that leeway early and it really served me well later on.
I think in a discussion session about the new PI career, you phrased something similar in saying that you have to decide what kind of scientist and what kind of mentor you're going to be. So what kind of mentor did you decide to be?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think that is an evolving thing. I think, you know, mentorship is something that we learn how to do and is shaped by the people who we work with. And, you know, I think especially during my own training from graduate school to postdoc, I sort of took qualities that I thought, you know, my advisors were really, really good at, you know, and I felt like my graduate advisor had this unique strength of being able to adapt to every single type of person. He had all these refugees like me that had come from somewhere else in the lab. And no matter, you know, what level of skill or expertise or what people were coming in with, everybody graduated and succeeded, right? And so, you know, I think from that experience, I sort of learned this idea that, you know, of not trying to turn everyone into the same person, right? But to, you know, complement people's strengths and give them what it is that they need in order to succeed. And so that was something I really learned from my graduate advisor because he was so effective at doing just that. And my postdoc advisor also had, you know, a totally different unique skill set in which he was able to, I feel like he recognized that, you know, at that stage of people's careers, you know, people know how to learn how to do science, right? they can teach themselves. That's the whole, you know, that's what we're all doing in science. You sort of find where those boundaries are and push against them to make new knowledge and to uncover new discoveries. And that's something that we all sort of know how to do. We know how to learn, right? And so he sort of understood that, you know, you don't necessarily need someone to teach you how to do science, right? But especially at that stage in your career, when you're a postdoc, what you really need is someone to believe in you, right? You need to get over the difficulties and you knowing the uncertainty of, you know, career paths and things like that. You know, what you really need is that level of support, the things that you can't necessarily get on your own, right? And so I feel like I took those sort of two elements and combined them and tried to, you know, and that along with what I learned from the people that were in my own lab, and trying to adapt to people and their strengths and make sure that they felt empowered and encouraged and, you know, supported in the ways that I knew it was so important for me to feel that way, right? So I think the combination of those things was somewhat, you know, became part of my philosophy. And then I always sort of felt that, you know, anything that we take a lot of trouble to learn, it's really important that we share it with others. So that's often why I ended up blogging about those things that I was learning as I was starting my lab, things that I felt like people didn't have to learn it the hard way, you know, that it might be useful. And I had learned so much. You know, I talked about two advisors, my graduate advisor and my postdoc advisor. But if we are being completely honest, the world was my advisor. You know, I was very much, you know, this is one of the reasons I really like social media, you know, and really like people blogging about their experiences, is because I learned so much from people that I didn't even know.
Well, and you also went on to create this new PI Slack platform. And I like very much one of the motivations behind it that you explained was when you went from being a postdoc to being a PI, you were part of a community as a postdoc that we all know, and that everybody hopefully helps. Not everybody, but there are enough people helping each other, and not just scientifically, but giving all kinds of support. And then and you say that when you become an independent PI, that the independent also has a downside, that people feel isolated and so forth. And how long has the new PI Slack platform been active?
So since 2016. So I think I started it in late July of 2016, and maybe even, and I think probably I put up that blog post that sort of like threw open the doors and invited everyone to come, and posted about it on Twitter. I think it might have been early August 2016. So that was a number of years ago now, I guess.
Do you have an idea of how many people are using it now?
So I'm no longer there, no longer new PI, trying not to, overstay my welcome. But I understand it to be, I think it's more than 3,000 people from across the world. Yeah.
Was there anything there that surprised you while you were still in your PI?
Everything. Yeah. I mean, I think the whole reason for the, you know, the impetus for doing this was exactly that. It was isolation, but also because everybody was going through the same challenges. There were so many independent laboratories of experimentation on how to do science and how to be a new PI, right? And there was so much data there, right? So much information that we could learn from people who were willing to share and help each other, right? And so I think that I learned a lot of things. I think everything I learned about how to do, you know, anything and how to make it through the most difficult challenges of being a new faculty, I learned from there. But I also, I think, learned about, you know, about building community and how important that is, and for people to feel like they have that level of support and that they don't feel isolated and independent, right? And I think just the whole idea of having an independent lab, you know, it's sort of like a misnomer, right? I mean, science, it's a collaborative effort. It's we all depend on each other, you know, and it's you know, there's often when we, you know, recruit people at the faculty level, we want them to have their independent contributions, and we recruit them for ways in which they're unique from the rest of the members of the department. And, you know, so they are sort of scientifically more in their own space, and also they're, you know, no longer, you know, have, you know, that sort of thought partners that they come along with, right? And then eventually that will develop as laboratory members come in, and then they become more experienced. Like that is the collaboration, right, within the own lab. But it takes some time, right, from going from an empty lab that's just you to having more people where you can collaborate with within your own lab, and then outside of it, making those collaborations. So I think that I learned a lot about, you know, sort of attracting and empowering people who had that sort of similar mindset of sharing what they knew, right? Not just coming to take what they could take and learn from it, but who wanted to contribute and help other people with what they've been, you know, that they had learned.
Speaking of collaborations, Prachi is also president of ASAP Bio, a scientist-driven nonprofit. ASAP Bio is EMBO's partner in the Review Commons initiative, a platform launched in 2019 to promote the curated peer review of preprints. Enter Review Commons project leader, Thomas Lenberger.
Speaking of collaborations, of course, you're a strong advocate for preprints. Did preprints play a role for you in this context?
Oh my God, preprints changed my life. I mean, the reason why I'm such a huge advocate is because it was so self-evidently a good idea. You know, I had heard, I tell this story sometimes, I had sat on my sofa in my house listening to the first ASAP Bio meeting, in which it was the first time I had really thought about or heard about, you know, preprints in the life sciences. And I found it so compelling, this idea that authors could be in control and could make their work public when they saw, you know, it was the right time to do so, right? And that felt incredibly empowering. It felt like it would completely change how science was done. We know we had evidence from the physics archive that this was going on and stable and working for a very long time. And, you know, my husband was actually a mathematician, and he had posted on the archive long before I ever posted a preprint on bioarchive. But I was aware that that this was a possibility. But the idea, this thinking for the first time when I was from my own lab making the decision about what do we do with our research. And then it was in that same moment, right? I had just started my lab, and then I learned about preprints, and I thought, oh, why would we do anything else? It makes no sense to me to just do anything other than, you know, to just share our data and get that feedback. And I think even today, we still, you know, when we think about it, we don't ever simultaneously send a paper to a journal. We just put it as a preprint, and then that's when we start the conversation with the community, right? If it hasn't been started already, right? It's just a opportunity to do this work collaboratively with the world and hear all the good ideas live where they live, not just in the people who we ask, right? you never know who will find that information and find it useful or find have resources that might help or anything, right?
And so for you, it really works. So people write to you and say, hey, I saw this preprint, I have these questions, or we could work together. And
yeah, so the thing that I actually tell everyone is that, you know, it is actually somewhat unrealistic to sort of say, I'm going to scream into the void and people will come, right? It's like, we know there's so much literature out there. It's nobody's job to follow what we're doing, right? Each of us individually, right? So in my mind, I always felt when you do something and you put something out there, if you actually want some feedback, you have to be proactive, right? So we don't just like drop a preprint and then good luck, let's hope something happens. You know, like, in fact, when we put something out there, I send it to everybody I know that might be interested in reading it. You know, we post a preprint right before a conference, and then we have a poster or a talk or whatever, and then we put the link to the preprint on there, and everybody who stops by, who bothered to come see the poster or came, you know, to the talk, we point them to the preprint and ask them specifically, like, if, you know, once you have a chance to read all this and see all the data in full, like, please let us know what you think and anything that jumps out at you. And so just in every way possible, you know, put preprint tweet threads out, you know, on Twitter and explain, you know, our thinking, not just what's in the paper, right? So all the way that things that went into making the decisions on why we did certain things, why we ruled other things out, having a richer discussion about it, and then putting that out there and into the world. So it's like a multi-pronged effort to try and solicit information. So yes, we always get feedback, but it's not just automatic.
Do you think that it sort of transforms scientists a little bit also in sort of PR agencies? I had young PRs talk to me, you know, about Twitter and said, I really, you know, I'm not so familiar with Twitter, but I have to have an account, because nowadays, if you don't promote your own science, you are nobody.
Yeah, and And, you know, and some people think about that as a negative thing, right? It's like, we are scientists, we are not PR people. And in my mind, I just think about the reality of the situation. You know, even as a scientist, and what do you read? What do you consume? You know, we are not individually following every single person, figuring out what everybody is doing, and only the people that we know. We want to know what is interesting that we might want to read, right? And when you look at that, like that sea of information, right? The reality of the situation is that there has to be some way to find what you're looking for, right? And so in my mind, I don't see it as separate from the job or something different or a different skill set. It's just doing the thing that maximizes our ability to do what we want, right? So in my mind, if I want the science to be better and more rigorous because it is an open conversation with scientists everywhere, then it's also part of my job to make sure that people see it.
And in a way, this is why we also have scientific conferences, right? It's to meet, and the social network is very important in science.
Exactly. And I think many of the things that people say about preprints, I would say, you know, is something we've already bought into because of conferences, right? This early sharing, you know, feedback from our community before, you know, before it's all the way complete, like all of these things. These are things we already know are good, right? It's true that we post things before we ever send them to a journal. And often, sometimes it'll be the third or fourth version that we send to a journal, you know, many iterations, like to try to make it better. These papers are the best papers that we have ever produced, right? Because they are an open conversation with the community, and they've already been, you know, thoroughly discussed by the time we send it. And that takes a lot of the surprises out, but it shaves a lot of the anxiety and time down, right? Just the idea that it can be out there and we can have that discussion, you know, before the version of record, right? Like just having that be out there years in advance, right? is unbelievable, right? And it just think about how much that advances science. We all know from the COVID example, right? Like we have vaccines in months instead of years or decades, right? Because of this open sharing, the open sharing of the genomes, the open sharing of all of the results that are happening. And yes, it's difficult to wade through all of that information, but it is unmistakable that open science makes everything happen faster, right?
To paraphrase social biologists De Borg, at this point in the conversation with Prachi and Tomas, resistance was clearly futile. But I wanted to get one last word in before we fully switched over to open access and open science themes.
I want to come back a little bit to where we were, because I know once we get off with you and Tomas on preprints, we are never coming back. And so
it's already pretty deep.
Guilty as charged.
No, I'm on board as well. So, but I just, there were a couple of things, also more recent developments that I think people are very curious to learn more about. And going back to your life in science, when you left neuroscience, you left also animal models in total, right? And you went to Chlamydomonas, it's also still a model organism, right? Even though you mentioned that you spent a lot of time first 5 years, I think, trying to develop tools for visualizing the act inside a skeleton and so on that didn't exist. That even though it is a model organism, the tools for the cell biology you wanted to do weren't there, right? And I think that really highlights the importance of model organisms, right? So it would have been even harder if Clammy hadn't been already pre-domesticated, let's say. And so now you're embarking on this new adventure with the Arcadia Institute. So first of all, maybe you could tell people a little bit about what it is, and how it's been set up, and your role in it, and then we can talk a little bit about model organisms and the Institute's mission.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are Arcadia Science, and this is it's really a research and development company. And the goal is to focus on emerging research organisms, like we talked about. And I think about those organisms not so much in a fixed way, right? For example, like you said, Chlamydomonas is a model system in the sense that it is a model for many different things, but the one that I was studying is it's a model for psyllium structure, assembly, and function, because the psyllium of a Chlamydomonas is very similar to humans, right? So it serves as a model because it's very similar to humans, but it's easy to study, right? So that's like sort of a traditional definition. But in many ways, Chlamydomonas is a non-model for other things. Like, for example, the actin cytoskeleton. It has a very conventional human-like actin, and it has a very, very different one that is not found in humans at all. And so this is something that I have always been interested in studying, right? Where you have two different actins living in the same system, something that is very, rare, and it gives us a totally new opportunity to understand how actin cytoskeletons are regulated at all, right? When you have actin-binding proteins that could interact with two very, very different actins. So that means that our thinking about how that actin and its actin-binding proteins interact with one another are completely based on only what we know and not on this sort of taking advantage of the diversity of, you know, cytoskeleton and cytoskeletal phenomena, right? And so when we think about that, in many, many ways, many different systems can be models and non-models, right? For understanding how evolution has solved biological problems. So we don't think about this in terms of X number of organisms are model organisms and X number are non-model organisms, right? It's true that some have more tools, some have critical mass, some have sequenced genomes, all of these things, right? And so the goal for Arcadia is not to turn non-models into models, but to ask scientific questions and then say, what is the right way to study this, right? What is the right system in which to ask this question? Where has evolution already asked this question? We can't do every single experiment, but evolution has done lots of them, right? And so if we look in the right place, those answers are already there, right? And we sort of intellectually already know this, right? We've found all sorts of different technologies and solutions in a wide range of biology, whether it's CRISPR or GFP or, PCR. So many things have come from like completely, you know, extremes of biology, right? And we know how useful that is. And so, but when push comes to shove, right, and resources are limited, that's not where we traditionally put our emphasis and our money, right? And so that's the thing we're trying to change at Arcadia Science, is to say, we can actually support that. We can solve some of the reasons why people aren't able to ask the right system, the right questions in the right system, right? So often people even will write traditional grant proposals and be told, oh, why don't you just do this in human or in yeast, because it's easier and you have the tools and things like that. But hopefully we can enable these things to happen. We can solve some of these problems for the community and say, now you can ask the questions that you want in the right system, and it's even more powerful and so much more can be discovered and found. And so this is the thing that we're really trying to do. But Arcadia is very much an experiment on many different dimensions, right? It's not just on the kind of science we do, but it's on how we do it. It's how we, fund it. It's on who's able to do it and how we communicate it, right? And so that's something that we are really also interested in, pushing the boundaries of what is possible in science if we really put, what we think makes sense to do in science at the forefront and try to solve the problems and, all of these things together. They're all connected, right? And that we think we can have the broadest impact in how this science gets done if we do all of that, those experiments together.
So before Thomas, who I can see bouncing up and down, jumps on the how to communicate it, I just want to get to the end a little bit of how to do it, or not to the end, but just to extend a little bit more. Some of my favorite scientists have strayed off, let's say, the beaten organism path. But there was always a kind of parachute in a way, not always, but for many of them. So, for example, the person who probably ventured out into the wild most in immunology was Louis de Pasquier, but because Roche was backing it at the Basel Institute of Immunology, or one of my all-time favorite scientists and people, Max Cooper, who went off with the jawless vertebrates and discovered incredible things. But there was always, a core of the lab that did mammalian immunology and a very good mammalian immunology. But that also helped to keep the lights on while they went off and did exploratory research in incredible organisms. So is what you're saying that Arcadia will fund the costs of doing, so it will be independent of external grants. People will be able, it's really the entry barrier is huge, right? When you can't pick up a catalog and order something from Jackson or from BD.
Yeah, so as you said, because of the ways in which we traditionally do science and fund science, it's very difficult to sort of do these very high risk things, right? Where we don't know whether we can solve all of the problems and all of that, right? And so, so in-house at Arcadia, it is not going to be grant funded. We will support all the science that's going on in-house. And that will hopefully allow us to solve many different problems across organisms, right? So hopefully, you know, different principles and things that we learn that we think can advance a lot of this science, we can do that for, you know, more than one organism. We can solve some of these problems and we can, you know, make all of that available, right? And so, but we won't have that barrier to entry. It allows us to do higher risk work. It allows us to explore more. It allows us to do the comparative biology. Most of the time, you sort of have to stick with your system because that's what you have expertise in. It's what you can get grant funding for. In this case, we actually want to say that, you know, sometimes making the comparison across systems, that is incredibly powerful, right? That can help us understand how the biology works. And that's something that traditionally would be difficult to get funding for, right? Even though scientifically it actually is extremely powerful, approach, but it might be difficult to support something like that. So that is, you know, we are very much focused on what can we contribute in, because of our, you know, our lack of certain constraints, what can we contribute that, you know, that is sort of uniquely possible because of the way in which we've structured this organization. You know, what we want to be able to do is demonstrate that the kind of science we think is so important and powerful that it has all of this tremendous value and have so many more shots on goal, right? Just say we're going to do this over and over and over again, and that this does have tremendous value, even commercial value, so that the people who right now don't see it, right? They don't understand that it's important to put funding into basic science, right? If we can demonstrate the value, we can get a lot different kinds of investors saying, wait a second, it is really important to put our money here. And then there can be 10 more Arcadias, right? Not just one, right? That to me, I just think that we need to maximize what it means for us to do this experiment. And that means in changing what the community is able to do, showing it has value so that, yes, we can be self-sustainable, but also that we can demonstrate that this is where funding should go.
Well, and in a way, you mentioned en passant several examples dispersed that where non-model organisms had immense value with PCR, with GFP, and as you were saying before. And I think that's a good point to transition to, Thomas.
well, so I'm curious to know now what are these experiments that you're going to run in terms of how you communicate the science made by. I think I saw on the website that you're looking for an editor. So Arcadia is a company, is a research institute, and it's going to be its own journal?
There's no journal. We are just releasing our data. so that is actually one of the things that we are hoping to do, is to actually get people outside of thinking that, you know, that communicating science can only look one way, right? Like, we haven't changed the way that we've done it for hundreds of years, right? We are no longer making print journals, and yet we haven't really come that far in making that, changing how we communicate it, both in the unit of publication, which, you know, many of us are trying to also change. It's not like we're the only people doing experiments in this space, but we not only do we not have to wait until some magical, product is complete and ready to go out into the world, you know, that we think there's huge amount of value in releasing information, data, ideas sooner, right? And so we want to change that thing, but also, you know, just because something is open doesn't mean it's useful, right? Like, there's certain things that we want the way we share the data, the way we display the data, to be maximally useful, maximally reusable, so that other people can actually download, reanalyze, do all of these things, that we can extract the most out of this data, right? You know, often what we do, people generate tons and tons of data sets, and then they take one little piece and then they make a paper out of it, right? And the rest of it is just there. You know, what we want is to enable everybody to use that data, make sure that they have all of the metadata and everything they need in order to extract what they need from it. And for people who are non-experts, but are, you know, experts in something else, they can still have access to that data and use it for their own work. Or people who are, you know, able to actually download in full and reanalyze it, that they can also make that contribution. You know, the whole thing is trying to think about, if we really wanted to maximize what is possible with what we are putting in, how would we do that, right? And because we want to break from any sort of prior system, we are not held back by any of those constraints, right? We can just say, if we were to reimagine it from nothing, what would we do? And how would we make the data most useful? And that is very much what we're trying to do. So we are looking for an editor, because I also don't want the scientist in-house to spend a huge amount of their effort trying to make it perfect. You know, the other reason people don't make their data open and they make their science open or sooner is because they're waiting for it to be perfect, right? But it's never going to be perfect. And it's only going to get better the more we, you know, earlier and more that we communicate it, right? By having other people look at it and help us make it more rigorous, right? And so if that's the premise that we're going after, we want to, even for our own scientists, get them to release that data sooner. And I think one huge part of that is lowering the activation energy and saying, no, we will have some support for you. Just you make sure that you accurately communicate it. We will have an editor in-house that will help make it better.
Can you tell us more concretely sort of in what form these units of information will be? Will they be figures? Will they be databases? Will they be a narrative, a single figure paper?
All of the above. So when you think about, again, like what is the best way to make things useful? So we do want to take data sets and deposit them in FAIR repositories, for example, right? Like we want to make sure that these data are someplace where they can be archived and they can are in the places that people will look for them and can be downloaded and reused. So we want to deposit all of these different types of data in the appropriate places, deposit protocols in the appropriate places to make sure that they are also accessible. And, you know, so rather than method sections, to have everything be a protocol that can be actually useful to other people, right? And so we're going to have all of those things deposited in the right places. But then, of course, we know that context is everything, right? Helping people understand, what is this data? How, you know, why are we pursuing these things? How are we thinking about it? How do we interpret these things? And of course, papers are the way they are because often it does help to have multiple orthogonal pieces of data, you know, testing a model, for example, right? And so we will have, you know, each of these individual things that may be useful to put out into the world and provide some contextual information, you know, right on our website that shows, okay, we've deposited these data set. This is what we did, what we think it means. We've deposited these protocols. But then also have times at which we collect some of this information, synthesize new ideas and say, what do we think this means? What, you know, ask questions of the community. What do you, you know, how do you think about this data, you know, with respect to other information that you're collecting, you know? And we want all of that feedback also to be public. I think that is another key feature of what we hope to do, is to make sure that the feedback on all of this is public, because the feedback is not just for the benefit of the author, and it's not just for the benefit of the reviewer. You know, it is very much for the benefit of the reader.
One question we receive sometimes at Review Commons, now that we, you know, we review only preprints, is how much our preprint compatible with patent applications. And I can imagine that in a for-profit company, it's a little bit of a trade-off, IP versus being open, as you describe. Have you thought about that?
Yes, of course, yeah. And so this is something that we also get this question a lot, because we are very much believe in open science, and also we are a for-profit company. But what we are trying to one of the other things that we are trying to make a case for is that these two things are not in conflict, right? Is that often what happens is that, you know, if we really, I think it is for the benefit of all science, even for commercial applications, for the science to be better and more rigorous, right? This is one of those things where often we think in many different sectors, right? Like in academic sectors, people are keeping their data closed because they're waiting for, you know, for the credit and all of these things, right? And even then, they end, you know, in academic science, people tend to patent things, right? But they patent things long before they're ever actually like useful for anything. So it doesn't even apply to the thing that ultimately it gets used for, right? And so in the meantime, it hampers, a lot of what's possible, right? And then in biotech, keeping everything secret for the purposes of commercialization, right? Again, so much of that is just discovery science long before, especially for us who are doing this basic science, the huge amount of it is going to be just discovery science long before we ever cross some commercialization desert, you know? And what we're hoping to do is basically to say, look, we are doing this kind of basic science. We think that there's ultimate value in it and that we can get people in-house who are good at seeing that value. That may not be necessarily the people who are digging into the basic fundamental discovery, right? So we want to get all these different types of people in-house. And then if we see that there is some path to that, right, some path to commercialization, that we can still continue to do that open discovery science, get good, rigorous feedback on it. And then if there's something that's useful, that actually, like that final molecule or whatever it is that can come out of that, you know, because, you know, sometimes the investors will not invest in that thing because it takes, you know, it takes a long time to get to that point, right? And so they may want like a 10x return on investment early, you know? And so if we say, okay, look, well, we believe in this. We believe in basic science, right? We will invest in that thing. And then ultimately, once you get to that one molecule or whatever, those, you know, we can enable those people to go off and start their own company. We can have, you know, equity in those things that can come back and, you know, if it goes on to make money, it can come back and sustain the institute, right? And so, but then they are off on their own company. They're not part of us anymore.
I'm very curious as to how that will work. Just think, so I'm not anymore, but I used to be an editor at JXMed. And one of the, there are several aspects to the process that are good in some ways. That need curation, right? So I to monitor conflicts of interest, to make sure that, you know, the people commenting know what they're talking about, which depending on which field can be innocuous or it can really, you know, have. So Arcadia is going to curate the review process of its preprints and of its online.
We're hoping to find ways in which some of that is more useful, right? And so, you know, where you have comments that are, you know, I think this is one of the things is that part of the problem, right, is that having those comments actually, you know, tied to like an accept or reject decision, right? Rather than adding to the richness of the data. We think of science as being a living, breathing body of work that can constantly improve, even things that were published and have a stamp of approval. You know, in some sense, it's a false sense of security, right? Like it's only had very few number of people that have been even that heavily curated, you know, commenting. And that is secret. It is very much, you know, has its limitations, right? And so we think that, you know, yes, of course, you know, it's one of those things that we are not afraid that even if there is, you know, because we're operating outside the system, you know, even if there are things that are off base, it's not hampering our ability to get into some journal or whatever. We're happy to engage with those comments and think about them, right? And so think about what's making our, you know, we do want to, that is very much the job of our people in house is to think about what are these useful comments? How can we make the science better? Actually, we can be able to, in the way that we want to, you know, demonstrate contributions on of the work that we're putting out, there are people who are commenting on our work that are helping us making it better. They will also be credited for helping us do that. It's a collaborative process that they're working on with us together, right? And so there, of course, there will be some noise in the system, right? And so, but it's all public too, right? And so this is one of those things where not everyone agrees on what's useful and not useful comments, you know, and just having that be a public conversation. And then we have to think about ways in which to, you know, distill, one of the problems with having richer information, right, is that you can't just rely on the stamp of approval anymore, right? And so we want to, of course, you know, make sure that it's useful, right? So we needed to have ways of distilling some of those things and, you know, but it's not going to be by hiding things that we don't want to see, right?
Maybe to conclude, you know, what would be your recommendation to really young scientists, you know, who just got their PhD? They have, you know, they have their own ego. They want to make a name in science. They have to have their first author, whatever. Maybe it's not going to be a paper. So they are very oriented towards themselves, and they have to do this path. On the other hand, yeah, they have to publish everything. They have to show everything, and they have to provide, you know, the rest of the world with their best ideas.
Yeah.
Well, how should they navigate that?
I think there is no substitute for, you know, there are proxies that we use for making an impact, which are these first author papers and whatever. And then there is actually making an impact, right? And I actually think that there is no better way to make a name for yourself than to make a difference to other people. And I think that if people would more, I would love for all young scientists to think in this way and think about putting science and society, you know, at the forefront of their mind, right? I think so often, even as scientists, because everyone can empathize with everyone else's plight, we are so willing to sort of throw that under the bus so that for our own career advancement. And I just, if we all just moved a little bit in that direction, right? Just to say that trying to do the thing that's good for science, it will be good for us. Of course, it will lift all boats, right? It just, everything that's good for science is good for us, right? And this is the way that we think, of course, for, you know, preprints are the perfect example. Like, of course, sharing your data is good for science. It's also good for you. It's good all around. But I would love to rather make the case for doing it because it's good for science, to do it because it's good for society. If we just all have that thing in mind and just and put that as part of our decision-making process, right? I just think it would be better for everyone. And I think everyone would see those benefits. And that I hope everyone, you know, can get more to that place.
Well, I think this is a wonderful thought for the conclusion. And thanks a lot, Pachi. That was a very energetic, and I think you're a very energetic person. And it's absolutely fascinating to really looking forward to see how all your projects are developing.
Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the chance to talk about all of the things that are of great interest to me and in science. I just it's a passion of mine, and I really enjoy talking about it.
We'd like to thank Prachi Avasthi for talking with us at the EMBO podcast. To find out more about Prachi's research, go to avastilab.org. To learn about Arcadia, go to arcadia.science. Thomas Lenberger is Review Commons project leader. Review Commons is the EMBO and ASAP Bio platform for peer-reviewed preprints. You can check it out and submit your manuscript at reviewcommons.org. Thank you for listening to the EMBO podcast.